Welcome to the Iron Mind Podcast. Join me, Josh Brumley, as we explore the minds of those who forged their paths through legal battles, business triumphs, and creative conquests. In each episode, we sit down with inspiring individuals who've sharpened their resolve in the fires of entrepreneurship and law. From lawyers breaking barriers to entrepreneurs overcoming obstacles, we uncover the stories behind their iron wills and innovative minds. Get ready for thought-provoking conversations, practical insights, and actionable advice. This is the Iron Mind Podcast. Thank you, Brian Chan, for joining us. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day and running your businesses to come down and be a part of the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Could you start by just giving us a glimpse into your background and your expertise on what accident injury reconstruction and biomechanics mean?
Yeah, great question. So I trained professionally as a chiropractor. I finished my chiropractic training in 2002. Began practice in 2003, and I've told the story recently in a deposition I was in, but essentially I received a report in the mail for a patient that I had seen, and it was an engineering report, and the claims adjuster had sent it and said, hey, we believe this injured individual's injuries are pretty minor based on this engineering report. And I remember reading it and being confused, not really understanding what this report was about and why was an engineer telling me that my patient wasn't injured. And so that led me on a bit of a path to try and understand what's going on and why would an engineer be involved. And so ultimately in 2008, I began some training when it comes to injury biomechanics. I decided to go a little bit further. In 2012, I went to Northwestern University Center of Public Safety, and I did their accident reconstruction training certificate program. It's a three-week course with law enforcement and engineers. Wow. Where I did a full accident reconstruction course. It's the same training that the State Patrol does, or the City of Seattle sends their detectives to learn how to reconstruct a car crash by looking at the roadway damage, the evidence on the road, looking at the car damage, looking at the damage to trees or any other evidence that they may find.
Skid marks,
yeah. All of that.
Yeah.
The weights of the vehicle, to try to reconstruct what happened before the collision that led to the collision. Mm. And so that sort of became my world. And it's been a lot of fun to understand this component of how someone might get injured looking at the vehicles also.
And so biomechanics is the study of how a body moves during a car crash?
Yeah, I think of it as three components. In a car crash, the first thing we look at is the physics of the car crash. That's called accident reconstruction, how the cars come together, the energy that's transferred from one vehicle to another vehicle. But ultimately, we don't care if a car has is injured, a car is damaged. We're concerned about an occupant. We're concerned about the biomechanics. So mechanics being the movement, bio being their body. So the biomechanics, we're trying to understand how their body moved, which would potentially contribute to how they were injured.
And so is frequently you're hired as an expert to testify about reconstructions and how someone might have been injured. Do you see you're used a lot more on severe cases or like maybe small property damage cases? What's more common in your industry for people to use a biomechanical expert?
I would say there's a general perception that if there's a lot of damage to someone's car, that you could be injured. I think that the question is not asked as often in that situation. So I would say in general, the situations where an individual's vehicle doesn't have a lot of damage, the question becomes, well, your car didn't have much damage. Could you be injured? And so I'd say I'm probably most involved in those types of cases, although last year I was involved with a case that, again, had little damage but very substantial injuries, tearing of the vessels in the neck, and that was a very substantial case. And so it really varies, but I would say in general, the question gets asked when there's not a lot of damage to a vehicle, yet the injuries are quite substantial. So those are probably the bulk of what I'm seeing.
How do you see biomechanical principles helping us to understand how injuries help in a car accident case?
From the clinical perspective, so I essentially wear three hats. I'm a clinician. That's my doctorate in chiropractic. That's my clinical training. I have training as an accident reconstructionist and training as an injury biomechanist. Those are three different things, right? As a clinician, I don't have to look at the car. I don't have to look at anything outside of my this patient sitting in front of me. The training that we have, essentially going through a physical exam, allows me to be a detective to figure out why someone would be injured. And so I'm able to pretty easily, through an exam, parse out the injuries. However, when there's a question of, are the injuries caused by a specific event, we have to look at the bigger picture. Accident reconstruction allows me to look at how the cars interacted and answer questions regarding why there is damage or why there isn't damage. Injury biomechanics helps me understand if, as a clinician, I'm seeing injuries. Were the injuries caused by this specific event, or was it caused by something else? Mm-hmm. It could be age-related. It could be working out in the yard. There's a lot of different causes why people have neck pain or back pain. And so injury biomechanics lets me take the physics of a car crash and apply it to the occupant to be able to answer that question, did the car crash cause this person's neck pain or back pain or shoulder pain or whatever injury they might have.
Interesting. How do you start the process of reconstructing an accident?
There's my method, and there are other methods that I don't agree with. Maybe I'll start with other methods. The other methods that I typically don't agree with would start with looking at the vehicle and trying to calculate the energy of a collision that's transferred from one vehicle to the other vehicle. And then based on the calculations, so my patient would be sitting in a car. We call that the target vehicle. The bullet vehicle is a striking vehicle. Mm-hmm. So if I have a patient sitting in the target vehicle and they're struck from the rear, the first step that other methods use would be saying, well, let's calculate the energy of the car crash based on the damage in the vehicle. If we know the energy of that car crash, we can determine the acceleration or the forces of the car crash. And then we would say, that method would say, if we know the vehicle's acceleration or the forces that vehicle experienced, the occupant must have experienced the same forces. So that's one method of calculating it. I don't agree with that method because the occupant and the vehicle are two different structures. We have biologic tissue that responds differently than the material that's made to construct a vehicle. And so there's different stiffness values. It just, the biofidelity is much different. And so we can't simply say, if we know what the car looks like, we know what the occupant and how that responded. So ultimately, the method that I do is I start with a clinical examination. Well, I start with a clinical examination, which gives me an idea of what the injuries are. Then I work backwards and I say, well, what could have caused this? My history has pointed me in a certain direction. I then look at the vehicles, and the vehicles will tell me the vector of the collision. I like to look at the property damage. I like to look at estimates. If I can see the car in one of my own patients, I'll go out there and look, because once I see the scuffs or the damage, I get a sense for what was going on. Was it a rear impact? Was it a side swipe? Was it a T-bone? Was it a frontal impact? All of those collisions, what we call vector, is the direction the force comes in the vehicle. Based on physics principles, essentially looking at Newton's laws of motion, we know that if I were to come up to you and push you from the front, you're going to try to actually push back against me, but ultimately you're going to move the opposite direction. But together the force, you know, essentially when I push against you, you try and push back against me. Mm-hmm. The same thing happens with an occupant when they're sitting in the car. If I know it's a rear impact collision, I know the occupant's going to want to move towards the direction that the force came in. Well, if they were to do that, what do they interact with? They interact with their seat back first. Mm-hmm. Their seat back loads up, then throws them forward. Now I know, were they wearing a seatbelt, yes or no? If they're wearing a seatbelt, I know they have to interact with a seatbelt. So then I can use physics to say what interacts with the body when a force is applied to the vehicle. So ultimately, I have to look at the vector of the collision. I don't have to calculate any numbers. I just simply need to know two objects collided. If we take two pool balls and we one's staying still and we roll one pool ball and it hits the other pool ball, that pool ball will move. We know what direction it moves. Well, we also know the way that the body would move too.
Right.
Using that, I can then determine what is a potential mechanism of injury.
So then, do you see like seatbelt injuries in these low impact cases? Do you see other types of injuries? What's part of the process that
the resolution. What injuries do you more likely see in these low impact collisions?
Yeah, I would say that the most common collision we're seeing is a rear impact collision.
Right.
And they are they are dangerous. Side impacts are also very dangerous. Injuries are slightly different because in a side impact, depending if it's a near side, which means it was a side of the car you're sitting on, or a far side, you could strike your head against the window, against the B pillar or the structure between the front and the rear door. And so we're now looking at more of a very hard structure that your body is striking against. In a rear impact collision, which is, again, is the most common one, we call those in a low property damage or low speed, which is typically less than 10 miles per hour or so. In a low speed collision like that, the collision is very elastic. We call it elastic. It's like a rubber band, like a rubber bouncy ball. When you throw it to the ground, it doesn't shatter. It bounces right back. There's a very high coefficient of restitution. So that ball wants to return to the same shape it was in, and that energy allows it to bounce in the opposite direction that it was originally thrown. So in a rear impact collision, a car strikes your rear bumper. Mm-hmm. Your rear bumper begins to push your car forward. You're sitting in the seat back. You begin to load the seat back, but even before doing so, the first thing you're going to feel is your seat pan push underneath you. That changes the shape of your lumbar spine, your low back spine. Your head wants to stay still because of inertia, but your torso begins to move forward. It's being pushed by the seat back. In doing so, it creates what we call an S-shaped curvature in your neck when you should have a C-shaped curvature. That movement causes damage to the discs, the facet joints, various structures in your spine, which ultimately are mechanisms of injury. It doesn't happen every time, but if a patient presents and they're having neck pain, we can typically say if it began a short period after a collision like this, it's typically caused by a car crash.
Interesting. That's very, very interesting. I think a lot of the accident reconstruction work that I've seen done by defense counsel has always included, you know, with this level of speed or delta V, delta 5, is it?
Delta V.
Delta V. So it, with this level of delta V, there should not have been injuries. Yeah. And that just seems so weird to me that my client, who's someone who wasn't in pain before and then had pain after the accident, they're going to say it's not because of our accident, it's something else.
That approach is very interesting because what happens is an engineer will calculate the change in velocity. That's what delta V means. Mm-hmm. So say that a car is stopped at a red light and therefore it's 0 miles per hour. It's now struck from the rear and calculations are made, and typically the calculation falls less than 5 miles per hour. And the reason why is 20 plus years ago there was some literature that said the threshold of injury was 5 miles per hour. So miraculously, the calculations always are like 4.8 miles per hour. And it's using physics, but we learned that when you do these calculations, it's always a range. Because when we're saying, well, it must have been 120 milliseconds, you didn't have a measuring device to tell you it was 120 milliseconds. You're just saying, well, the average rear impact collision is 120 milliseconds. So let's just use that number.
Right.
And so it's acting like a very specific science. When it actually isn't. Regardless, the formula always works in the favor of saying it's less than 5 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is there's been some studies of volunteers wearing accelerometers, and they will say, let me plop into a chair. Let me cough, let me sneeze.
Oh, yeah.
And it's measured. So these studies have been published saying, hey, to sneeze, it causes 1.4 Gs to your neck when you sneeze. And we call these activities of daily living. You sneeze, you cough.
ADLs,
yep. Correct. And so what happens is the engineer will say, I've calculated this to be 4.8 miles per hour, which is under the threshold of injury that we believe to be possible. And then we also calculated it was approximately 1.2 Gs, which is like sneezing.
Yeah.
And they want the reader to then say, well, then no one can really be injured. So why is that done? I think it's misused. It's inappropriate. And it comes down to this. Josh, you and I have different past histories. Perhaps you were a football player. Perhaps you were a professional wrestler. Whatever it was, your body's history is different than mine. Your training's been different. your ability to withstand forces is different. We just had a Super Bowl this past weekend. Those players are watching as they're preparing to hit someone. Their body prepares for that. If you were to turn that player around and strike them from the rear, there's a high likelihood they would be injured because they're not prepared for it. And those are trained athletes. Now we take the average person that is driving down the street, stopping at a stoplight. They're waiting for the stoplight. Suddenly they get slammed from behind at 4.8 miles per hour, at 4.5 Gs, at 3 Gs. The question is, when in their life have they trained for that type of force?
Right.
Never. It's not something we train to do. And so the risk is when you're not protecting your body and not prepared for that, then some of the more substantial structures in your spine can become injured. And ultimately, we see those injuries quite often in these type of collisions.
Very interesting. How do you consider human aspects like posture or seatbelt use and how occupants move during an accident?
Yeah, that is probably one of the crucial steps that I feel clinicians actually miss. As a clinician, we don't typically go out and look at a car. I do, but I'm also a freak. I like to look at and understand the physics.
Yeah.
And I try to sort of imagine what happened, the collision, how they moved. But the typical emergency room, urgent care, chiropractor, primary care, we're not thinking of that. We're thinking about the patient in front of you. But in my situation, what I want to look at is I want to understand, did they hear any noise beforehand? Were they preparing? Some patients will say, yeah, I came to a quick stop and I knew something was going to happen. I saw a car coming and so I braced and I know that the risk of injury drops. What the research shows is that if we are able to guard for a potential collision, it reduces our risk of injury, which is sort of at odds with the idea that the drunk driver got thrown from his car and walked away without any injuries,
yeah.
Right? But what we're seeing in the literature is that's not the case, that if you can guard and protect your spine, you've got a lower risk for injury. But essentially, out of position occupant has been shown through research. What they'll do is they'll follow a group of patients after a car crash. And essentially it's called a prospective study where they identify the demographic. They follow them over a period of time. And they say of these 100 patients, 70 of them were injured. And of those 70 patients, 20 had chronic injuries even 2 years later. And then they say, what are the difference between those 20 that were injured and the 50 that were injured for 6 months and the 30 that weren't injured at all? And what they found is being out of position is a risk factor for injury. Why is that? Well, the body, again, it's all physics. And we have a seat back that's meant to protect us, to stop us from going too far back. Now, if they were leaning to the side and completely missed their seat back, there's a risk. They don't get to interact now with the seat back. The injuries change a little bit. This case that I was involved with last year, very, very little damage to this individual's vehicle, $500 to $600. But this individual actually tore vessels in their neck. Well, as I dug into it, and the question became, that can't be related to the car crash. And what did I do? I said, well, let's understand your positioning. And what I found out is he was in his work van. He was actually leaning over a stoplight, looking at the middle console at an invoice. Then he was struck from the rear. Knowing the principles of physics, he didn't have time to now get in the right position, make sure he hits the seat back. He completely missed his the head restraint. His head hit the metal divider behind his seat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In addition, his seat back didn't have any deflection because it was pressed right up against this metal seat. So essentially, he got hit by a very rigid structure, and his head continued to move forward, backwards until it struck the metal barrier.
Right.
This allowed for tractioning of his left anterior neck, which is a location of these aneurysms that he ultimately experienced. So to answer your question, knowing positioning and knowing what the literature has shown will help us identify risk factors. Another one, head turned. Mm. Someone that has their head turned and are waiting for traffic to clear and suddenly get struck, they're at a very high risk for more substantial injury because in this position, they've loaded some of the joints that typically aren't meant to be loaded in this held position. If you and I turned our head and just held it like this, after a minute or two, you begin to feel uncomfortable. Imagine that position and then being struck. I can also show you that if I look straight ahead and I tuck my chin, I can go further. If I turn my head to the right, I can't move my head in that same position. I've got less motion in that position, which means the joints are already at its limit, which means if I have a sudden force and my head begins to move backwards, I've got a higher risk for injury. So knowing positioning is important. Additionally, shoulder injuries. If someone is complaining of a shoulder injury, I need to know what was going on. How does a shoulder get hurt for, say, a passenger? Passenger's not holding on to anything. They're not holding on to a steering wheel. They're not bracing or jamming their shoulder against the steering wheel. Mm-hmm. How do I know what happened in that situation? The literature tells us that interaction with a seatbelt is a risk for injury. So if they're a passenger, we're typically seeing in the U.S., because studies have been done in Australia, in the U.K., where they're sitting on the other side of the vehicle, and it swaps. Mm-hmm. So we know that it's consistent. But essentially in the U.S., a passenger, front seat passenger, we're concerned for right shoulder trauma after a rear impact collision, because as they begin to come forward against that seatbelt suddenly latches, and it creates a fulcrum around that seatbelt where they can have injury to the rotator cuff or the labrum. So understanding positioning, seatbelt use, were they holding on the steering wheel, knee, hip injuries, was their foot on the brake, all of those things help me as a biomechanist be able to understand the physics of the collision and how that their body responded to the sudden force.
Very interesting. Do you use any tools or methods when you're doing this analysis, or do you do any modeling for trials?
So there are computer modeling that you can use. I typically have not, and really because I've not been able to determine a threshold of injury for any. I can't take a patient and say, your threshold is 3 Gs. The only way we could do that is actually taking that patient and putting them through a series of car crashes until we injure them. And I don't think we'll get approval. You have to get institutional review board.
I would let my client do it.
No, we can't get the right approval to do this type of testing. So we don't really know. And so I don't rely on modeling. The one piece of technology that I do use, which has been really helpful, is the black box data. Mm. And black box data, you think of an airplane where the crash happens and they find the black box. It's similar in a vehicle. And beginning 2012, it was mandated in the U.S. federal government made it required that any vehicle manufactured for the U.S. had to have black box data available for download. We call it the event data recorder. Mm-hmm. What is the event data recorder? Essentially, it's what controls the airbag. Now, if you can think back prior to 2012, there were airbags. The difference was the U.S. government didn't make it available for scientists, engineering, biomechanists, reconstructionists to be able to look at. Now we can look at that data, and we can actually go after a car crash and plug in to the vehicle, and we can, using some software, access the event, which is now recorded into a hard drive. And I can sit there and see what happened 5 seconds before a car crash. I can see if it was the bullet vehicle or the striking vehicle. I can see if they were braking, if they're accelerating, if they're swerving. I can see all of that.
Right.
If you're sitting in the car, sometimes we can see that. And the reason why is in a rear impact collision, there is no airbag that will deploy. So it's not as sensitive. It's supposed to still require it's still supposed to record some information if it
like
hits a certain
event.
Threshold.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
The older ones, we didn't see it as often. The newer ones, we're seeing even rear impact collisions. Why this is helpful is this. The people I typically oppose, the experts I typically oppose, they know if they can start the collision being at a lower number. Number one, if we can start with a low delta V, change in velocity, if I can say the car was struck and only moved 2 miles per hour, their calculation of forces in that collision are lower.
Right.
The higher that number they start with, the more difficult it is to get a lower number. So what used to happen is this. Well, there's no crush damage to the bumper. And these bumpers have been rated for 5 miles per hour. This is actually a very silly approach, and I won't name the expert, but there's a handful of experts currently in my community that will say, well, let's just look at the bumper rating. And they'll say, this bumper is rated for 5 miles per hour. Therefore, if the bumper didn't fall off, the collision must have been less than 5 miles per hour. So to be fair, let's say it was 4.9 miles per hour, and then they get a low calculation. If we're in a hurricane, if we're in Florida, and you have windows for your home, you can get a rating on the windows, right? A storm rating.
Sure.
How much miles per hour that storm, that window should be able to withstand. Now, if you buy an 80 mile per hour storm rated window, does that mean at 81 miles per hour, the window will break? Is that a guarantee?
Nope.
No. The manufacturer says they have to hit that, but they often are going to shoot pretty far past that. The same with a bumper. I've done my own crash testing, and these bumpers go 10 miles per hour, 11 miles per hour. Still, they look pristine, just some scuffs, okay? Mm-hmm. So the reason why black box data, getting this technology is important is this. You now can't lie. Before, you would say, well, this bumper is a 5 mile per hour bumper. It didn't fall off. Therefore, the collision had to be less than 5 miles per hour. Now we have to say, well, what does the data show? I was in a recent case, and actually the engineer had to rely on the black box data. They went and downloaded it, and you can't ignore, you can't manipulate it.
Right.
The data is the data. And that collision showed, this vehicle just had scuffs on the bumper, and the collision showed it was like 5.6 miles per hour delta V. So right off the bat, this black box technology helped us to start with the right number to be able to get more accurate numbers down the road. So that is a one technology that I've adopted in the past 5-6 years that I think is important.
And different manufacturers have different tools that you have to, like plugins to do their black box data, right? You have to have different tools for different manufacturers.
And maybe because Bosch, I believe Bosch is a U.S. company, but they really have a monopoly on it. They've done a great job. So I mentioned that before 2012, where there's airbags, you could get this data. And Bosch, since the 90s, in some vehicles like GM, we could get data. And Bosch was the first to make that data available.
Wow.
through this kit that you buy.
Mm-hmm.
Bosch has slowly brought other manufacturers onto their platform.
Oh,
so originally, Kia, Subaru, Mercedes, like all these companies had their own proprietary technology that you had to buy. So as a reconstructionist, I'd have to buy 5 different kits to be able to download. Bosch has now convinced Subaru to allow them to use their platform. And so they're slowly all moving towards Bosch. Tesla still has its own proprietary. You've got to buy their kit to do their downloads. But I hope one day it's all Bosch. But Bosch, typically 90%+ of the vehicles for the U.S., we can get through the Bosch kit.
That's great. That's great. Can you share any memorable cases? I mean, you already have, but anything where biomechanics was pivotal in unraveling this injury case or this defense that you had at a trial or that didn't have to go to trial because of your work being involved?
Yeah, I can think of a case a few years back of a woman that was in a pretty substantial T-bone collision. It was actually just a city street in Seattle. And she was driving a large SUV. And she was T-boned and it spun her car. She ended up hitting a pole. It's pretty bad, lots of damage in this vehicle. But they had a question, the opposing party had a question. They denied that her chronic back injuries was caused by the car crash. And I ended up doing what's called an IME, or an independent medical evaluation, where I did an evaluation. And I was able to confirm that the problem was a sacroiliac joint, a specific joint that's a part of the pelvis. And the question then was, why was the SI joint injured in this collision? And as I went through the reconstruction, I was able to determine that she actually jumped on the brakes right before getting T-boned. And that sudden force of getting on the brake plus her moving forward put a load onto her right foot, her right ankle, her right knee, her right hip, and ultimately into the SI joint. So through the principles of reconstruction, understanding the vector of the collision, understanding how the force came into her vehicle, which means she would move the opposite direction, and seeing her contact, her most direct contact was foot on the brake, a load on that right lower extremity went into that right SI joint, the right sacroiliac joint. So through the principles of accident reconstruction and injury biomechanics, I was able to tie in this chronic sacroiliac joint with the specific injury, the collision.
Right.
And I was able to connect the collision, the factors in the collision with the specific injury that she was suffering, and make that connection so that the trier of fact could make a determination of what was connected. So that was one that I was involved with. I also mentioned the one that had the pseudoaneurysms in the neck based on positioning. And
so speed and body damage, while obvious when they're more severe, are not as obvious to whether or not a person is hurt in low impact collisions.
I just explained this in a deposition last week that, you know, the attorney that was asking these questions was saying, well, wouldn't you agree that if there's a lot of damage that you've got a higher likelihood of injury, and if there's not much, then it should be lower? And I said, you know, I don't see a direct correlation. I think that in general, when there's a lot of damage, we know it's a very high force collision and we're concerned for injury. But I've had patients that were in substantial collisions where the trunk's been pushed in 10 inches and I do an evaluation, there's no injury.
Right.
And the reason why is in a injury where there's crush, I mentioned these low property damage, lower speed collisions. We call them elastic because it's like a bouncy ball type of collision. Mm-hmm. Well, the ones where there's lots of damage, we call that a plastic collision because it collapses. And when things collapse or crush, energy is used to create that crush.
It's absorbed.
We don't really say absorb, but essentially, okay.
We'll cut that out.
It takes energy to take a piece of metal and to collapse it. And so that energy is used in that situation. In an elastic collision where we don't have that, we have no deformation, the energy is transferred to the next vehicle. And so I think that's a concern with these elastic injuries, these elastic collisions, is that we do have quite a risk for injury.
Very interesting. Do you have any advice for lawyers who are either dabbling in personal injury or maybe new attorneys who have yet to have their first trial? Any advice that would help them in understanding when they should use a biomechanical expert or to help with your process to make sure it's as smooth as possible if they do retain you?
Yeah, well, the first advice is maybe not directly correlated, but it's my passion in life now to say, get the data.
Get the car crash get data.
Because the problem is, if you have a car that's older and has mileage on it, and say there's $2,000 worth of damage, that car may be totaled out. And when they total that out, they're getting rid of evidence that could be helpful in explaining what happened in your case. And so I tell all attorneys that if you're involved with injury care or injury, someone that personal injury, and it's vehicle and there's vehicles involved, that you try to preserve the evidence. And it may not just be your client's car, and maybe the other person's car. Mm-hmm. And I've been involved with cases where it's a three-car collision, and the patient is in the middle car, and ultimately the frontmost car provides an opinion they felt two impacts. I felt two impacts. And the generally insurance accepted belief is that if the frontmost car in a three-car collision feels two bumps, then the middle car must have struck that front car first. So that's tap one. And then when they slow down, they get struck from the rear. So then the blame goes to that middle car. And that could happen. I believe that does happen. But that doesn't always happen. And a black box data will tell us what happened. It'll show you the order. Patient 5 seconds before impact was driving, braking. 2 seconds before impact, they're at 3 miles per hour. 0.5 seconds before impact, they're stopped. Mm-hmm. The first event that's recorded is a rear impact. The second event that's recorded is a frontal impact. The third impact that's recorded is another rear impact. And then the fourth impact is the front car. That front car still felt two impacts. That middle car essentially was like a ping pong ball.
Yeah.
Just sort of back and forth between those collisions. I've been involved with cases where the black box data proved what happened. And so get that data, get that information before it's destroyed, before it's more difficult to confirm. If your airbag deploys, when the airbag's replaced, if the car is not being totaled out, they will typically also replace the airbag control module.
Oh, wow.
Because once there is an actual deployment event, like an airbag deploying, once that happens, that event is hard-coded, hard-written on the hard drive, which means you can't overwrite it. Mm. Okay, so because of that, these hard drives had limited space, getting better now, but had limited space, so they could say we could record two hard-coded events, and then after that, we won't record anything. And so typically, insurers will say, no, let's get that out, because if someone goes down a hill and hits a tree and then rolls over and hits another tree, it needs to be able to record multiple events.
Right.
And so that data is going to be gone. So number one, that's a side thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Get the black box data. It's very affordable to hire someone.
What's the average cost range for getting the data?
$500 to $1,500 to get that. Yeah. It's, and it really just depends on how far I've been in Yakima. You know, just wherever, it depends on travel and such. But if it's in the area, a client can even drive the car to where I'm at, or someone else that does a download, and it saves time, and then it's pretty affordable to do so.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but when they get that data, is it in an already formatted report, or is it sort of like the Matrix where you're reading all these numbers on a page?
It's a semi-legible report that Bosch does. So the system gives you a PDF, mm-hmm. and you can actually read. First of all, it starts with the limitations of the data, and it tells you sort of positioning, left means this, or positive means this, negative means this. And then it goes into it, and you'll see event number one. It'll show you ignition cycle. So I'd say the average person could read it, but you would need someone to interpret it.
Right.
There's training that I went through to learn how to interpret it. But typically what I'll do is I'll say, hey, what questions do you have? Okay, let me get the data. And then I'll tell you what the data shows.
Right.
And does that fill in your picture of what happened? And so that's typically what it would show.
And to get the data is $500 to $1,500. Mm. To do a report, what's the average cost to write up a report for
it really just depends on your time, on how much time it takes. Mm. Often what I'll do is I'll get the data, and then I'll speak with the retaining, if it's an insurance company or a claims adjuster or an attorney, I'll then call and say, what questions do you have? This is what I'm seeing. And then I'll ask them, do you want a report or not?
Mm-hmm.
And if they say yes, please put that in a report, then I'll just write up those findings, put in a report, and send it off. I charge based on my time, mm-hmm. just my hourly rate. I would say that other reconstructionists may just have a whole package, but it's going to be somewhere in the $1,500 to $2,000 range to grab the black box data, interpret it, and provide a report.
Very affordable.
Yeah. And sometimes even cheaper. If it's just a matter of you come to my office, I do a download, I tell you what it shows, and that's all you need. And that gives an attorney the confidence to say, hey, the other side was saying it was my client's fault, but we know this black box data shows the contrary. Let me give you, I have so many examples of this.
Yeah, please.
I had a patient, an attorney reached out and said, hey, I've got a client. And what happened, it was a four-way intersection, and a typical standard intersection. Everyone had stop signs, okay? And so my client said she came to a stop and then proceeded through the intersection. She was then T-boned by a vehicle. Now, this client was an immigrant, okay? And I'll say that because I think in some contexts that when someone's English isn't their first language, they could be taken advantage of.
Absolutely.
And I believe that's sort of what happened here. But essentially, she came to a stop, entered the intersection, was T-boned. The attorney reached out and said, hey, I've just talked with someone that said that they believe it was not their fault, but they're being blamed for it now. And so I said, well, tell you what, why don't we download the black box data? I'll download your clients, and you let the insurance company know that you want me to download their clients, or they could do their own download. And so we downloaded his client's information first. And the report showed this. 5 seconds before impact, she's braking. We don't know where. We just know that she's braking and slowing down. 1.5 seconds before impact, we show that she's completely stopped. 0.5 second before impact, we see that her foot's on the accelerator, and now she's going 6-7 miles per hour. And then the next thing we show is there's an event, side impact. So what did this prove? This proved that she was telling the truth. She that came to a complete stop before entering. Now we've said, why don't you show us on your side what happened? They would not agree to show, And ultimately, they accepted fault. They knew at that point. So my point is that a very simple download of that, I think it was $350, $400 to get that download, allowed the attorney to know that they could accurately represent their client without having a big question mark about liability down the road.
Huge. That's very, very helpful information. Yeah. So last but not least then, any advice for attorneys who are interested in working with you? How can they understand when this case needs an accident reconstructionist?
I always say this, that if someone's injured, the question is really a clinical question. That if your client has chosen good providers to receive care from, and those providers are confident with the diagnosis, you don't need my help at all. That's my goal. I actually don't want to be hired. I would hope that you never need someone like me. Mm-hmm. But the question is, why do you need someone like me? It's because if a client has been injured and they haven't sought the right providers or they haven't received much care, the insurance company now is going to hire a provider. That provider is going to say, you're likely not injured. That's what their evaluations typically find.
Yeah.
They're going to then hire an engineer who's going to say the forces were so low, no one could get injured in this. And now you're stuck in a situation where you need to bring someone on like me. So the typical situation I get hired on is an attorney that's in a bit of a desperate situation, and they say, hey, I've got a case I can't get resolved, and now I believe my client, they have a great reputation, they're a school teacher, you know, someone that we trust in public that's not trying to rip anyone off. And I believe my client, and they've got some good providers, but the other side is really geared up and hired these individuals. That's tough to fight. I think for many attorneys, it's intimidating because there's math and physics involved.
Right.
My role is, in a case like that, I get involved and I try to analyze and understand what the other side is saying. And I do an evaluation or a records review, and I try to understand what happened here. And if I feel like I can help, I'll let an insurance company or an attorney know that I can help. And if I feel like I can't figure it out, then I let them know I can't figure it out. Right. So it's actually really low. I don't like to get involved with a case unless it's something that I can help.
Right.
You know, for me, it's not about making an hourly wage. It's about helping someone understand what happened in the collision. And that's both with insurance companies as well as law firms.
Thank you very much. What do you think is the most fulfilling part of doing this work?
I still remember a case out in Clallam County, and I drove out there to testify. And it was a woman that was struck when she was coming to some appointment in downtown Seattle. And she was struck with very little damage, struck by a construction truck, like a pickup truck. Very little damage to her vehicle. She was in her late 20s, and she was riding horses. And she was in town for some appointment. She got struck from the rear. Went through care, but because she's in a more rural area, wasn't able to get really comprehensive care. Mm. And this case now is going into litigation. And in this case, I was working for the plaintiff. This injured individual's attorney reached out to me and asked if I could help. I did an evaluation. I figured out what the injury was, and said I'd be willing to testify. And so I drove out there. I testified, and then I left. And as an expert witness, ultimately, I'm not involved with what happens after I testify. In this case, I received a call from the attorney a few days after the case wrapped up. And this attorney said to me, it was very interesting, this attorney said to me, my client started crying when the jury read the verdict. And the attorney told me this was the largest soft tissue verdict in Clallam County. And she was emotional. And he said to me, he was like, this is the first time that I cried since the Seahawks won the Super Bowl. And that sort of stuck out to me, that that the role that I was playing would help someone be able to properly explain what happened in their collision, and that they would have this opportunity, and they felt like justice was got it right in that situation. That meant a lot to me, and that's sort of what drives me to continue to help. Is that I know that behind what I do, there's an individual that may or may not have been hurt, and I'm trying to help figure that piece out. So that's why I enjoy doing it.
Well, thank you very much for what you do. Thank you for being a guest. I'm really excited to spread the word about your services. How can people reach out to you if they want to retain you?
Yeah, the website is consultwithcare.com. Mm-hmm. It's, I'll be honest, it's a very low-tech website. it's staffed by myself. And so there's, you know, I don't have a big team that does this. They can reach out. They can also email me at Dr. Brian. That's just D-R-B-R-I-A-N, Dr. Brian. At consultwithcare.com, all spelled out, and that'll go right to me, and I'll then reach out, and we just have a quick 15-minute conversation to see if it's something I can help out with.
That's great. Thank you very much, Doctor. I really appreciate your time.
No problem. Thank you.